And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people direct to your earbuds. And it's a podcast dealing with subjects that are so transcendently important. And as I get started with this new edition of Hank Unplugged, I want to read a very quick review in hopes that you will do the same thing. Rate and review wherever you're listening to the podcast. This is a 5-star review by Yeshua Mishak. And he says, in part, Hank, I called into your program many years ago with an eschatological question that you did not answer the way I was expecting you to answer it. Unfortunately for me, I immediately stopped listening. Why? Because you didn't tickle my ears. I've been through many things since then, and thanks be to God that He's brought me back to your path, and this time in humility. I'm so grateful for your teaching materials, for your radio broadcast, and now for this spectacular podcast. I've binged for hours. I'll be recommending to everyone that will hear me, be recommending that they give the podcast a listen. I have no idea how I made it this far outside of the Eucharistic communion of believers, but God is faithful and His grace is amazing. God bless you. It's a rather long endorsement of the podcast, but that's the essence of it. We get so many 5-star ratings, and of course, that helps the distribution of the podcast around the world. Well, today I have a dear friend and one of the most brilliant people on the planet. I've known him for many, many years. His name is Dr. Francis Beckwith. He's a philosopher, and he teaches in the areas of religion, jurisprudence, politics, ethics. He's a professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University, and he also serves as an associate director of the graduate program in philosophy and an affiliate professor of political science. And he is the author of some incredible books that we have recommended over the years, including Politically Correct Death, subtitled Answering the Arguments for Abortion Rights, A Law, Darwinism, and Public Education, and the book I want to focus on today, titled Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft. And let me say this about this book. It'll go a long way to helping you understand what is essential to know about government, about its laws, as well as natural moral law and natural rights. And this book is going to enhance your understanding of politics and Christianity. If you don't have a copy, go to the web at equip.org. It's our resource of the month. It's available for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. Frank and his wife, Frankie, make their home in Waco, Texas. I've been there many times because my son, one of my 12 children, has a philosophy degree from Baylor. And my son-in-law, Adam Pelser, also is a professor of philosophy at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And I think was associated with Frank in some way or other. Frank can tell that story if he wants to. But I want to start, Frank, by welcoming you to the podcast. I'm so happy to have you here.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Hank. It's a delight to be here. Adam was a student of mine in the doctoral program at Baylor. So that's how I got to know Adam.
Well, he is such a great addition to our family. He's a great father. He's quite brilliant in his own right, and he's a great husband. He and my daughter, Katie, my second oldest daughter, they've just got a terrific family, and he's doing a terrific job at the Air Force Academy. He's really making a difference while there's yet time.
Yeah, we're very proud of him at Baylor. You know, we've had many doctoral students graduate in secure positions, and Adam being at the Air Force Academy is something that we're really proud of.
Hey, Francis, let's talk about the title of your book, Statecraft as Soulcraft. What does that mean?
Well, it's a kind of shorthand way of saying what Aristotle taught, the ancient Greek philosopher, and that actually was picked up by most thinkers in politics up until really the modern age, and that is politics is not just about having an orderly society and enforcing criminal law and contracts, which, of course, it does involve all those sorts of things. It also is about making sure that people are at least allowed to be good, not just good in terms of relation to the civil and criminal law and the political institutions, but being good citizens and good people. That is, statecraft, that is the role of the state, is to sort of form the soul. Now, of course, as a Christian, I don't believe that, you know, government saves you. But, of course, living in a regime where, let's say, you have religious liberty, or you live in a regime that is at least favorable, deferential to faith, you're more likely to flourish as not only an individual, but as part of a community of other individuals that are flourishing. So statecraft is soulcraft is simply saying that the law, the government, the institutions, the public institutions, make us who we are. And this is the part that I think a lot of people don't grasp, is that even if the government says, we're not interested in soulcraft, it does do it anyways. It's just the very nature of a public institution to inform people about what is good, true, and beautiful. Even if you happen to live in a nation like most Western nations that claim oftentimes to be neutral on moral questions, the government really can't be neutral on such questions. It's going to, in one way or another, tell us what is good, true, and beautiful. And it's going to shape the souls of its citizens by doing so.
Yeah, and you pointed out many times the character of an individual influences the character of the culture, just as the character of the culture influences the character of the individual. You mentioned the word politics just a moment ago. What is the etymology of the word politics?
Well, politics comes from a Greek word, polis, which means the city. And so it involves, in a sense, the community, and not just as a collection of individuals, but as an entity that is greater than those individuals. So for that reason, politics, at least the way I define it and the way it's been traditionally understood, is more than just, let's say, electoral politics. So we think of, for example, in 2020, we have a presidential election, and it's just about politics. Well, politics doesn't just involve elections and electioneering and voting. It also involves the sorts of kind of informal rules that arise in neighborhoods, right? Or our local ordinances, any sort of association that involves some set of rules that transcend the individuals is, in a sense, political. In a sense, the family is a kind of political institution in that sense. And this is why Aristotle taught that the family is sort of the beginning of the city. It's for the building block of the city. It's not in itself a city. In fact, he says that it's not a perfect state, because in order to have a perfect state, you need more than just one family. You need a collection of families that have members who do all sorts of things that none of us can do on our own. This is why we have different professions and, you know, jobs and, you know, talents and so forth. And of course, political institutions arise so that those activities can be protected and sustained in an orderly fashion. But yeah, politics is, in terms of its etymology, just refers to kind of the simple word, the city. But the city, you know, is not in the sort of modern way of city, but just any sort of collection of individuals that have a communitarian life together.
You know, politics is really connotative, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people will say, I'm not a politician, because of all of the baggage now that is attached to that word. But if you think about it denotatively, it gives you a completely different perspective.
Yeah, it's like when people say that they don't like lobbyists. I joke with my students about this. Anytime somebody's running for office, you'll get something in, like a mailer or something advertised on social media, and says, I'm not like those other politicians. I won't be controlled by lobbyists. And I will ask my students, how many of you have money in the bank? And of course, they all raise their hand and go, oh, you have a lobbyist. You know, your bank has a lobbyist. I said, you're all students here at Baylor, right? Guess what? I hate to inform you, Keller has a lobbyist. In fact, Baylor has more than one lobbyist. It has several of them. In fact, I've actually been at the law firm in Washington, D.C. that Baylor hired to lobby for. You know, it's part of the nature of living in a free society in which we have representative government for people to actually be involved with politics. I mean, what's the alternative? You know, the alternative is tyranny. Right? I mean, one of the things that's in our Constitution is in the First Amendment, in addition to the freedom of religion and freedom of speech, is the right for the people to assemble and to petition their government with grievances. Not everyone can do that on their own, so they have to hire people to do it for them. Not to say it's perfect. It's got its imperfections. Not to say that we shouldn't be critical of lobbyists when it's appropriate. But yeah, politics does have that connotation today of being almost like a dirty word.
You know, one of the most helpful parts of your book, Politics for Christians, at least from a personal perspective, and other people have indicated this to me as well, is where you explain what a liberal democracy is. A lot of people, when they hear the word liberal, have all kinds of ideas of what that might mean. And the same thing is true with democracy. So explain both parts, the liberal part and the democracy part of a liberal democracy.
Yeah, so let me just start with the second part, democracy, because typically when you hear the word democracy, you think of popular vote, right? Everything's run by majority vote. And so people tend to think, and rightfully, you'll often hear, you know, I've listened to talk radio once in a while, people say, we don't live in a democracy. And what they mean to say is this: we don't live in a nation that votes on everything. You know, we don't vote on every law, that is to say, as individuals, right? We vote people into office that represent us. But the word democracy, at least the way it's been traditionally understood, liberal democracy doesn't mean that everything is voted on. It simply refers to the kind of equality that human beings share. That is to say, I am just as much a citizen as the president of the United States. We don't live in a monarchy. I oftentimes tell my students when I went to law school 20 years ago, I called it the great democratizing experience. And what I meant by that was I went to law school, I had a PhD in philosophy, and I thought I was going to just ace everything, and I was humbled. And I realized that I was just one of 50 students in torts class. We were all equal. So that sense of democracy, this kind of like equality that we have, but it doesn't mean that we vote on everything, because that would reduce to mob rule. And this is why, at least in the United States and in the American founding, we have a constitution that limits the power of groups for the purpose of securing that equality. So imagine if we did vote on everything directly. You would have cases where if you had popular enthusiasms, you could have tyranny, right? Because you could have a tyranny of a majority, and that would technically be at least a kind of rough democracy. But that gets us to the first part of liberal democracy. The word liberal really means liberty. That is, that there are certain fundamental liberties that the government is obligated to protect. And we typically think of those liberties, at least in the United States, in our Bill of Rights. But even prior to the Bill of Rights being put into the Constitution, the understanding was that the Constitution was to limit the federal government so that communities throughout the United States in the differing states can pass laws to advance the common good of those communities. And so when I use the word liberal, I don't mean it in the sense of like liberal versus conservative, which is the kind of way in which we talk in our popular politics. I mean liberal in the sense that there are fundamental liberties. And so in a sense, everyone today, virtually everyone, I'm sure there are likely exceptions to this, but today, if a person calls himself a liberal or a conservative, in a way, we're all kind of liberals, right? I mean, we all kind of believe that there are fundamental liberties. To be sure, there are deep disagreements on certain issues. But that's the way in which I explain liberal democracy. It's not simply, at least the democracy part, it's not simply you know, this kind of 50% plus one is how we determine the law. And in the context of America, the founders understood that that would be just a recipe for tyranny. You needed a variety of other institutions that were not the result of direct election. So we had sort of the federal government, the U.S. Senate, which at the time was not directly elected. They were chosen by state legislatures. And you had the representation, direct representation in the House of Representatives. You also had the court system. Plus, you also had the different states. And so the founders kind of assumed that human beings, if given too much power, have a tendency to be tyrannical. And so they created a system in which they thought it would be more difficult for any one group or individual to take over. And so what some of us today or some people will say, oh, we've got too much gridlock. The founders would say gridlock is good because gridlock means that people will be forced to have to negotiate disagreements in a way that would result in compromise and so forth. Of course, the question today is, have we truly sustained that kind of government? And that's, you know, an argument that people are currently having, to be sure.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're alluding to this, actually directly addressing this, but we're called, as a nation, a constitutional republic of separated powers. And as you're pointing out, that has tremendous significance.
That's right. So one of the things that's happened, and this is something if I were to revise Politics for Christians, and I'm actually thinking about after the election going back to my publisher and asking to do that, I would include something on what is called the administrative state, something that a lot of Americans know about, but they haven't really thought about. And I bring this up, Hank, because I think it has a direct effect upon the idea of a constitutional democracy, at least as understood by the founders. Think about some recent Supreme Court cases that were highly controversial. They've usually involved, at least the past decade, the Affordable Care Act. One was called the contraceptive mandate, and the other was a lawsuit about the penalty that the Congress had put on those that refused to get health care or to purchase health care. Well, the contraceptive mandate was the result of nothing in the Affordable Care Act law. It's the result of a regulation issued by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. What a lot of Americans don't realize is that most of the laws that are issued in Washington, D.C. are not issued by Congress. They're issued by administrative agencies that Congress gives the power to issue regulations. So think of all the alphabet soup organizations, the IRS, the EPA, HHS, DOE. They'll issue regulations. All these are the result of administrative agencies. And so what's happened over the past 15, 20, maybe 30 years is that Congress hardly involves itself with passing laws, and they leave it to the courts to have to decide, you know, what is constitutional or not in terms of assessing these regulations. And I think that's really bad for liberal democracy because it means that the laws that tend to be the most controversial, the most contested, the ones that make it to the Supreme Court are not directly connected to Congress. And so when you hear criticisms of the administrative state, that's what people are talking about. And those individuals that are in those administrative positions are not directly elected by us. They're chosen by the executive branch, and some of them have permanent political appointments. You can literally, this is sort of amazing, you can be prosecuted by the IRS, go before an IRS court based on an IRS regulation that wasn't passed by Congress. You essentially have a kind of alternative government. And it's remarkable. And it's something that, you know, when I wrote Politics for Christians 10 years ago, I had not thought a lot about, but I've seen more and more criticisms of this over the past decade or so. And I think it's something that I guess a lot of Americans don't truly grasp or understand, and how inconsistent it is with the founders' vision of a constitutional republic.
Yeah, you mentioned the word constitution a number of times. We often, as Christians, talk about the art and science of biblical interpretation. Is there an art and a science to interpreting the Constitution properly? And are there different perspectives? Some people are originalists. Other people think that the Constitution is a living document. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, there's different schools of thought on that. The view that I'm sure most of your listeners have heard about over the past couple of weeks is called originalism, which is a view that's associated with the late Justice Antonin Scalia and the recent nominee to the Supreme Court, Amy Coney Barrett. And it's the view that we should interpret the Constitution as it was originally understood. A lot of people misunderstand this. They think that it's the view of original intent. And in fact, Scalia himself did not like the term original intent because his thinking was it's not what the authors or founders intended, it's what the words meant. So to give an example, imagine when the 14th Amendment was passed, where it says that one's life, liberty, or property cannot be taken without due process of law. Then there's another part that says that the government has an obligation to enforce the law equally. It's sometimes called the Equal Protection Clause. Now, imagine that there were some people, I mean, clearly there were people who were involved with the 14th Amendment who thought that the Equal Protection Clause permitted racial segregation. And so their intent was that it not be extended or thought to make racial segregation illegal. Well, it took almost 100 years, but in 1954, the Supreme Court said that's precisely what it means. That is, people should be treated with equal protection under the law. And even though there were clearly people that wrote the 14th Amendment who were segregationists or would have been segregationists, it doesn't matter what the words mean, not what people intended them to mean. Right? Or what they speculated how they'd be applied in the future. So I think another example I use with my students in class, imagine you're asked by your boss, let's say you're the partner in a law firm, and you're asked by the senior partner to chair a search committee for a new hiree. And the boss comes in and he said, I want you to hire the best person. Oh, and by the way, my son is applying. So when he says in his mind, the best person, his intent is that you hire his son. Well, it turns out, let's say, you don't hire his son because it turns out he's not really the best person. So it's what the words meant at the time, not what was in the heads of the people who authored the 14th Amendment. And this is not to say that there aren't going to be disagreements among originalists. There are, to be sure. Now, some of the other views, there's a view that's associated with some more liberal justices, which is the view that it's sometimes called the living constitution view, the term coined by the late Justice Brennan. And it's the view that the Constitution sort of has to change with the times. And what's unusual about that view, I think a problem with that view, is that it tends to buy into this understanding that history is always getting better or progressing. So to give you an example from Justice Brennan's reasoning, in a couple of cases involving the death penalty, he argued that the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, he says, well, today we recognize the death penalty as being cruel and unusual, so therefore the death penalty is unconstitutional. Now, Justice Scalia has pointed out in several writings, the Constitution itself presupposes the death penalty. It says that the government can't take life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Well, if you can take life with due process, then clearly the death penalty is accepted. And the other problem with Brennan's view is that he's imagining that somehow we're going to become a more gentler and kinder culture as time develops. But if, let's say, we become a more barbaric culture and somebody says, well, I don't think cruel and unusual should exclude, you know, torturing people, because after all, you know, we're progressing and we believe torture's good now. So Scalia's point is that we have to look at what was meant by cruel and unusual when that was passed at the end of the 18th century, because it may not be the case that Justice Brennan's future where we become less barbaric is in fact going to be the case. Better that we tightly tether the meaning of that amendment to what was intended at the time. If in fact we want to change it, we have an amendment process to do that.
You've been studying politics for many, many years. You have an encyclopedic knowledge of the Constitution. Talk for just a moment about the brilliance of our Constitution. I don't want to put it in the same class as the Bible, but the more I study the Bible, the more enamored I am with the Word of God. And I suppose someone that studies the Constitution as you have has an elevated appreciation for just how grand a document this really is.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of reasons to appreciate and sort of stand in awe of our Constitution. I mean, one is that it's the longest standing. I mean, it's remarkable. You think of other nations throughout the world, Western nations, who have had over the past more than 200 years a variety of different types of governments, right? They've gone from monarchies to liberal democracies to, you know, versions of that under parliamentary systems. And yet we have stayed, I mean, our Constitution has remained the same, right? I mean, we've amended it. But I think the brilliance behind it is this. Now, think of this is what the founders were facing when they created the Constitution. In 1776, we fought the Revolutionary War, and we had something called the Articles of Confederation, which was a kind of loose set of rules for the 13 states that were once colonies. The problem, though, was that nobody was really sure whether we were really one country or were there 13 countries, right? And so there was just all sorts of problems concerning currency, contracts, and we created a constitutional convention where they convened a constitutional convention in which they hammered all these things out. And so there were two things that the founders were concerned about. One concern, they wanted to have something that was a united collection of political entities, which we call states, that had a kind of a certain level of independence. On the other hand, though, they wanted to have a strong enough central government that would not become tyrannical like the government that they just fought a war against, the United Kingdom. And so they were deeply influenced by thinkers like French writer Montesquieu, John Locke. They were very well versed in classical learning, thinkers like Plato and Aristotle. They were obviously formed by their Christian inheritance. Some writers, in fact, I had a student a couple of years ago who was going to write a dissertation on the influence of the Christian view of original sin on the American founders, that their sort of skepticism of political power was not just the result of their experience. It was also the result of their theological beliefs about human fallibility and frailty and original sin. So all these factors are in play. And so they come up with a constitution that has three-pronged federal government that allows states to have their own governments. But not everyone's totally satisfied with this. There were people at the American founding called the Anti-Federalists. And the Anti-Federalists, they weren't satisfied with the Articles of Confederation either, but they were really skeptical of having a strong federal government because they thought, are we going to go through the same thing again here that we went through with Britain? So that's how we get the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is essentially a compromise between the Federalists, people like James Madison and others, and the Anti-Federalists. And so the Bill of Rights were put in as a limitation on federal power. So, for example, in terms of what the states can do. So this is why we have strong prohibitions against things like self-incrimination, limits on freedom of speech, very strong language about religious liberty and religious disestablishment. In fact, in the First Amendment, where it says that Congress shall not establish a religion, that's a limitation on Congress. Six of the original 13 colonies actually did have established churches. And so what the original understanding of the First Amendment was that there could be no federal church and that the federal government cannot interfere with states that wanted to have established churches if they wanted to. Now, the last state gets rid of its established church in 1832, and then eventually in the 20th century, the Supreme Court starts applying the First Amendment to the states. And that's a whole other story for about the history of the Constitution. But getting back to your initial question, Hank, the brilliance of it, I think, is the result of a real practical, real-world understanding of human nature and also a deep conversance in kind of political philosophy, both ancient and modern, that the founders were deeply aware of. These were very well-educated people. They were classically trained. They knew not only the Bible, they also knew the ancient Greek philosophers. They were well-versed in modern philosophy, medieval philosophy. They also knew about what had happened in other parts of the world, right? They were on the verge of starting something that the world had never seen before. And so there's a bit of courage there too, right? I mean, for us, we kind of take this for granted. Oh, liberal democracy or constitutional republic, that's old hat, but it was new and had never been tried before. And so I think the brilliance of it is the result of just, you know, perfect timing with just the right collection of individuals.
And the providence of God. Talk about the benefits of a liberal democracy. You laid them out so well in your book. We sometimes take for granted the incredible privilege that we have. We can participate by voting. We have the liberty to worship. We can hold the government accountable, and many other things that you lay out in the book. And I think that has to be emphasized in this podcast, because if we don't have a high value placed on those benefits, we may well lose those benefits because we're not underscoring them, not only individually, but for our families and within our churches.
That's right. So there's so many benefits. You've already alluded to some of them. Think about how we take for granted the very fact that we're having this conversation, right? And we're having this conversation, it's going to be broadcast to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who will hear it, and we will say things that people may disagree about. We could, if we wanted to, discuss actual public policies and maybe be critical of people in elected office if we wanted to be, right? These are all part of our fundamental rights. We have the right to own property. We have a right to privacy. The government can't break into our house or take our papers without having a warrant, and it needs to go to a judge first. If we're taken to court in a criminal trial, the burden is on the state. And if we're going to be convicted in front of a jury of our peers, we have a right to counsel. And these are all things that are part of the infrastructure of our legal and political worlds that is unusual, at least in terms of human history. And what you mentioned about the possibility of losing it, and I kind of have that fear, Hank. I see many young people today who think of things like freedom of speech and freedom of religion as kind of interfering with what they think are the goals of social justice, or people that are frustrated or impatient with our criminal justice system. And I don't want to blame it entirely on them. I think they just haven't been enculturated in terms of their education as to why these things are good. So, you know, we've seen several cases over the past 6 months, you know, concerning the police and accusations of police brutality. And I'm not going to comment on any individual cases. I don't know enough about them. I don't know enough about the facts of those cases, but in the past, when I was growing up, if we read about cases like that, I remember my father would tell me, well, you know, you're just reading what's in the newspaper. You're not in court. You don't know what the jury's going to hear. You don't know the evidence in the case. Don't jump to conclusions, right? That's the way people kind of handled, right, these sorts of controversies. Not everybody, to be sure, but people had an understanding that we had a system. And the system may be slow, the system may get things wrong, but the alternative to that is far worse. That is, to allow the mob to decide based on emotion and sentiment and enthusiasm who deserves punishment and who doesn't. The processes that are in place are meant, at the end of the day, to protect us from tyranny, even if that means that sometimes injustice wins. And I think that younger people today, some, not all to be sure, don't fully appreciate that because they see on social media, which is something that I thank God didn't exist when I was growing up, they see things and they say, oh my gosh, this is horrible, something's got to be done, it's not moving fast enough, therefore there's an injustice, let's burn things down. That is precisely what will lead to tyranny, because what will happen is that somebody will swoop in, an elected official, a politician, I will do what's right, I will end all the bad stuff, and in exchange for your freedom. And people, unfortunately, we've seen this in other nations, have done that. I think it was the late Francis Schaeffer in his book, A Christian Manifesto, who said that the great temptation will be to exchange our freedoms for peace and prosperity.
You know, with the coronavirus, you've seen how quickly people are willing to give up their freedoms, even churches.
Yeah, it's stunning. And I, you know, I'm a person that when this was first happening, kind of wanted to take a step back. I'm not an epidemiologist. I don't know enough about the science. But I do know that in any sort of public policy judgment, there's going to be a trade-off. So it can't be that we must do everything we can to eliminate a virus, because if you did that, you would ultimately, you may actually result in more human misery, right? The sort of misery that results from mass unemployment, depression, which results in things like alcohol and substance abuse and so forth. So, yeah, I was stunned at how quickly, and I can understand, because I was somebody that initially who, you know, obviously I still think that, you know, we have an obligation to our neighbors to act in ways that don't harm them. But on the other hand, in the cases of churches, if in fact the government is treating churches or burdening churches in a way that it would not dream of burdening casinos and bars, which is what happened in my home state of Nevada, that I think should be a wake-up call to Christians that the government doesn't think your faith is that important. They think that strip joints and bars and casinos are more important. And so when you hear politicians saying, well, we just want to keep open essential services, but churches must close, I mean, the judgment there is that church is not essential. And that, I think, is, you know, not consistent with our tradition of religious liberty.
Yeah, well said. You've mentioned the rule of law. And one of the points, and I think this may be in your book, I can't remember whether it is or not, but the second president of the United States, John Adams, of course, he famously said that our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people, and that it's wholly inadequate to the government of any other. In other words, it's not possible to rightly govern under our Constitution a world without God. What do you say about that?
I think Adams is right in this regard, that there's more to law and political institutions than the rules that are written down. That is, people have to be enculturated into believing that these things are good. And of course, and this is the element I think that Adams is driving at, that these principles are ultimately derived from something transcendent. That is, when we say, for example, that we have human rights, or that we believe that the role of the government is to advance the common good, that leads to another question. Well, what constitutes the common good? Well, you could obviously appeal to these sort of fundamental rights, but Is it the government itself that creates those rights, or is it simply the government recognizing that there are these fundamental rights, that they sort of exist apart from government, and that they are connected to the sorts of beings that we are? That is to say, how are we designed? What is our end? Now, if you go back to medieval philosophy, and my favorite philosopher, Thomas Aquinas, he defines the common good ultimately as our seeing God as he truly is, you know, what he calls the beatific vision. And so for Aquinas, all our institutions, although they are there to protect and secure these, you know, finite temporal goods, ultimately those temporal goods point towards something beyond themselves, right? So I'll give you an example of what I mean by this. I began about 2 years ago when teaching at Baylor, asking my students why they're in college. And you'll know in a moment why I do this, because there's been, over the past maybe 4 or 5 years, a real kind of a diminishing of the humanities in the academic world. There are fewer philosophy courses, fewer courses in literature, and the emphasis now is more on what are called the STEM areas, science, technology, engineering, and medicine. And all those are obviously very good. So I ask my students, why are you in college? And they all say, to get a good job. Why do you want a good job? Well, I want to make money. Well, why do you want to make money? Well, because I want to have a family. I want to be able to take care of my children, maybe give to right causes. Well, why do you want to do those things? And there's usually awkward silence, and one or two students will say, because they're good. But why be good? And is there something beyond those goods? And my point is to tell them that all these goods in life are all instrumental goods that we engage in for the sake of this one good, right? And then I tell them, that's why you're in philosophy. that's what we're, so in a way, what we're doing here is the most important thing. That is, we are talking about the ultimate reasons why you do all these other things, right? So getting back to Adams, I think Adams is saying something that, look, a constitution or any set of laws or fundamental documents in a nation should be worth more than the paper it's written on. But if you have a society that consists of citizens who are not inculcated and enculturated with these principles as true, it doesn't matter. You know, think about something like freedom of speech. You and I grew up during a time where, you know, it wasn't unusual to hear people say things like, I don't agree with what that fellow's saying over there, but I will defend his right to say it, right? That kind of thinking is vanishing. And you'll hear things like, well, you know, I don't like what that person says. It makes me feel bad. I think the government or the social media company should silence him, right? And when you say to people, well, don't you believe in freedom of speech? They're not embarrassed to say, no, I don't. And so why is that? Well, they've not understood, never been taught why freedom of speech is good, why we need it, why sometimes we have to tolerate speech that we don't agree with, just like we tolerate religions we don't agree with, right? Because what's the alternative? You know, a tyranny. But it also is grounded in something else Adams and some of the other founders had written about, and that is that these liberties allow us to find the good. So James Madison, in his famous letter called Memorial and Remonstrance, which was a letter he wrote, it was actually a pamphlet that he wrote to argue against the paying of Christian teachers out of the Virginia Treasury. And his argument was that the government should stay out of the church and the church out of the government, because human beings should be free to worship God, because who knows, your neighbor could actually be right about something and you can learn from him. So ultimately, these rights are grounded in, you know, a good greater than those particular goods. And it's something that I think today it's become very foreign to the way most people think about, or at least in my experience, a lot of people think about fundamental rights.
You know, you said a couple of things that tempt me to go on a tangent, and I think I will. You mentioned just a few moments ago that the church oftentimes is not considered to be essential. So casinos and strip clubs are considered essential, but the church isn't considered essential. And I was thinking about what you were saying, and then you mentioned Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas. So here's the tangent. You know, Thomas Aquinas had an experience in church. And as you mentioned, I mean, this is someone to be revered. He was developing his Summa. He was trying to codify all truth into a coherent whole, a truth from anthropology and from science and from ethics and psychology and from political theory and so forth. And then he had a Eucharistic encounter with the real presence of God that radically rearranged his priorities. And I think that points to something. It points to just how essential the church is in a liberal democracy. And I think about Taiwan, for example. Taiwan is one of the developed nations that did the very best with coronavirus. Well, they had been down this road before. They had SARS. And so when coronavirus came along, they didn't panic. They didn't lock down. But I found it very interesting that Buddhist temples remained open, but many churches closed down. Mm-hmm. Eucharistic assemblies closing down. They did it not because the government tried to close them down. They did it because they wanted to close down. They thought it was best. So here you have a country that is not enforcing a lockdown, but the church has sort of enforced that lockdown on themselves. And I think this has something to say about how we have depreciated just how essential the church is in any nation, much less in developed nations.
Yeah, and I think it has a lot to do with the role that an individual or, let's say, a church thinks about the faith. So think of you mentioned Aquinas' experience. I just wanted to jump back to that for a second. I mean, he was right in the middle of the writing of Summa Theologica when he had that, and afterwards he told his assistant, everything I've written up to this time is just straw. And he never wrote again after that. That's how profound that experience was for Aquinas. But if you go back to the way in which the founders thought about religion, I mentioned earlier Madison's Moral Remonstrance. For him, one's relationship to God was likened to being under another sovereign. And so he saw that one's religious liberty wasn't like a matter of choice, per se. So let me explain what I mean here. When I say, for example, I can't engage in an activity that violates my conscience, I'm not saying I don't want to do it. I'm saying I can't do it. And it's because I'm under the authority of the sovereign I did not choose. But in American culture, and I think this is widely thought of, I think even in societies, even though they're not historically Western, they've been influenced by Western mores concerning religion. You mentioned the churches in Taiwan, that somehow religion or going to church is sort of another commodity. You know, it's as if you choose your religion like you choose, you know, your toilet paper and your grape juice when you go to the supermarket. And the American founders thought that, obviously, they knew people converted from one faith to another, but they didn't think of it as a matter of like pure volition, that people were oftentimes moved by conscience. They were oftentimes swayed as a result of what we would say is like a movement of the Holy Spirit. They knew Quakers. They knew that there were people like this, and that for this reason, the government should make it as difficult as possible or try to craft laws in a way so that church and state conflict as little as possible. But the willingness of churches to acquiesce so quickly I think is the result of just religion as just a kind of, you know, something that's done on Sunday, right? And that there is really nothing per se special about the building or the activities that go on there. And you can just sort of watch them online. And I think the people in the government see that. And there obviously have been exceptions. There have been several lawsuits throughout the United States over some of the lockdown measures. But I think the view of religion as almost like a kind of hobby is the way in which I think many elected officials think of faith.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I mean, it's the difference between church and church life. You know, church properly understood, ecclesia, is not just something that you go to in hobby fashion, but rather it is a life, and therefore it cannot be treated lightly. There's so much I want to get to, and one of the things I was thinking about as well is something emblazoned on my own mind, something that President Theodore Roosevelt said. He said that every thinking man, when he thinks at least, realizes that the teachings of Scripture are so interwoven with our whole civic and social life that it'd be literally impossible for us to figure what life would be if those teachings were removed. We'd lose almost all the standards by which we now judge both public and private morals, all the standards to which we, with more or less resolution, strive to raise ourselves. So this matter that we've been talking about, the significance of the church, the significance of holy tradition, the significance of the Holy Scriptures is not to be trivialized. It is to be underscored, and particularly in a discussion like the discussion we're having today. But I want to talk about liberal democracy and why liberal democracy cannot be pure democracy. This seems to be a sticking point for people today. People want to get rid of the electoral college. They want to pack the courts. There's so many things going on in our culture that are terrifying to me. Explain to our audience, as only you can, why a liberal democracy cannot be a pure democracy.
Well, it's because tyranny can be manifested not only by, you know, one individual like a dictator, can also be the result of majorities that may perceive the destruction of minorities in their interest. And this is why we have, in our form of government, kind of different levels at which representation is manifested in order to, on the one hand, allow consent of the governed, which is a kind of shorthand way of referring to the pure democracy, that is, individuals voting on representatives. But we also have courts. We also have a divided government, not only between the different branches of the federal government, but the different state governments. And it's also because, if you think about what exactly is the point of the government, right? Well, the point of the government is to allow our common lives to be exercised in a just and fair manner. And the fact is that there are a variety of different communities within different geographical regions, right? They're widely diverse, right? I live in Central Texas, which is much different than Los Angeles or Charlotte or Hibbing, Minnesota. These are widely different places, right, with different traditions and histories. If, in fact, let's say you had this sort of crude democracy, right, we vote on everything all the time, and let's say we eliminate something like the Electoral College so that whoever's elected president, you know, just gets the pure majority or plurality vote, right? Well, what happens in terms of the wide diversity of communities? Now, imagine if today we didn't have the Electoral College. Do you think that, well, of course, this is an odd year anyway, so, but imagine if we didn't have COVID-19 and the candidates were campaigning. Would you think they'd campaign? Would they spend any time in Iowa or some rural community in Wisconsin. No, they would just go to those places that were the most populated, right? Where you had, you know, all the big industries, all the people who had the most money, right? So what you would get, ironically, is less diversity. You'd have, in a way, less representation, right? You would have, the focus would just be on those areas of the country that were the most densely populated. And why would a politician want to waste his time going to Montana or Idaho or, you know, the rural parts of, let's say, northern Tennessee, right? But when you have, I think with something like the Electoral College, kind of recognition that there are geographical differences and that, yes, individuals are equal before the law, but the fact is that we have just a wide range of different types of communities that have different types of industries, different cultures and traditions, and so forth. So I think, I don't know if that adequately explains it, but there's a couple of different things going on in our republic. One has to do with, again, consent of the governed, right? So there's the democratic part of it, but also acknowledgement of just the differences that we have. And if we just had a pure democracy, you would not have the restraints on government action. Imagine if the courts were, you know, simply under the authority of majority rule. Is it perfect? Absolutely, it's not. But today, like, we have an individual that was appointed by President Trump, Amy Coney Barrett. The president, whomever he happens to be, appoints somebody to the Supreme Court, but the person doesn't make it to the court just like that. He or she has to go through the U.S. Senate. The Senate has to confirm that individual, and that individual will go through, as we saw last week, a sort of battery of questions and interrogation, and people may not like that, but that's part of the process. And these particular processes are put in place so that tyranny becomes less likely.
You know, Frank, I think it is so important for people to take the time to digest your book, Politics for Christians, because, I mean, I can foresee a time. I couldn't maybe 10 years ago when you originally wrote the book, but I can foresee a time today where you have major politicians urging us to get rid of the Electoral College, politicians talking about packing the courts. I can see that becoming a reality in our lifetimes. I honestly couldn't see this 10 years ago, but now you can see it. And it's so important for us to understand how we could easily degenerate into mob rule if we get rid of these aspects of our liberal democracy that make it so brilliant, so poignant, so profound, such an arbiter of liberty.
Yeah, and what people don't realize is that, recall the United States of America, right? We have these political jurisdictions we call states, and the United States consists of not only its citizens, but citizens that live in the particular states, and those states themselves have interests, right? So if you eradicate that, if you eradicate the distinctions between the states and just make them no different than really large neighborhoods, I think you're right, Hank. I mean, you're fundamentally changing the nature of this country, and I think it's going to change the way people obviously run for president. So, you know, we've had now, I think, since 2000, how many? Two elections where the individual that won the Electoral College did not win the
popular vote. Yeah.
Or the popular vote. So you'll hear, well, so-and-so didn't win the popular vote, but nobody campaigned for the popular vote. You know, they campaigned for the electoral vote. So that's a really unfair characterization, right? So, you know, going back to 2000, Bush versus Gore, right? That was the first in my lifetime of somebody losing the popular vote and winning the election. And so, oh, you know, Gore won the popular vote. Well, no, he won the collection of all the votes that was the result of campaigning for the Electoral College. I mean, it would be almost like saying, oh, you know, let's say the Dodgers win the World Series. Yeah, the Dodgers may have won 4 out of 6 games, but the Rays got more runs. You know, you wouldn't.
That's a great analogy.
the way the game is played is that it's each game, right? So if the game had been played differently, if let's say the Dodgers and the Rays were told you're going to play 50 innings in a row and whoever gets the most runs at the end wins, okay, that's the game. But the game here is you're trying to win states, right? Because we are the United States of America. So in any event, I think that people don't appreciate that, even though the Electoral College, yeah, once in a while the person who doesn't win the popular vote wins the Electoral College, but that is the result of the way the game is played. If it had been played differently, who knows what might have happened? We just don't know.
I want you to talk about natural rights and natural moral law, because liberal democracy assumes natural rights. And if we didn't have this assumption, it would have a dramatic impact on things like the abolition of slavery or racism and the like. So this is a very significant issue that you tackle in your book.
Yeah, so let me just define what I mean by natural rights and natural law. So the kind of example that virtually all your listeners would be aware of is the claim in the Declaration of Independence where Jefferson says that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, including the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What he's essentially saying there, and if you read the rest of it, he talks about the role that the government plays in protecting those fundamental rights. That idea is not something obviously unique to Jefferson or newly introduced. It goes way back. In fact, even in the early days of the church, right, there were Roman writers that talked to us, including Cicero, who talked about what we would call natural law. Paul the Apostle himself brings up this understanding in Romans. I actually think Jesus presupposes it in some of his sermons. He says, would a good father give his son, you know, a scorpion and say that it's a loaf of bread, right? He assumes that people know what a good father is, right? So basically what the natural law is, there are certain fundamental goods that human beings are ordered toward by nature that we can use our reason to judge about. So think about something like life. We're ordered towards life. Now, we're ordered towards it as a good. And it's sometimes difficult to grasp. You think, well, how do I know that that is what I ought to do? And the example I use in class is I ask my students, imagine if you heard of somebody, let's say a friend or a relative who took his own life. What would be the first question you asked? They would say, why? Why did he do it? What if your friend said, oh, I saw Fred walking across the campus? You wouldn't ask why he was alive. You wouldn't say, well, why is he doing that? Why is he alive? It's because you already assume that he is ordered towards the good of life. And if somebody takes a life, either their own, that's a justification or a reason. Even if you think the justification is wrong or not appropriate, you still expect a reason because you know the good to which we're ordered. Years ago, I had a student when I was at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, who asked me whether the truth was important, and I answered, do you want the true answer or the false one? And so the natural law essentially is saying that we have these kind of natural inclinations to these goods, and now to extend it to the political sphere, that the government should recognize these goods to which we're ordered and make sure that the law makes it easier for us to be able to exercise those goods and not to harm our neighbors. So one of the other goods of the natural law is being able to get along with one's neighbor. And so we construct a body of laws that, in fact, make it easier for us to do this. So think about, let's say, freedom of speech. So a natural lawyer would ask the question, why do we have freedom of speech? And, you know, he would answer in this way. Well, we have freedom of speech because human beings are ordered towards communication. But why is communication good? Because one can express ideas and it could lead to friendship and understanding and knowledge, which are themselves goods. And so the idea that there is a natural law is kind of baked into the idea of what it means to be a human being. And what the founders appealed to when they appealed to natural law were those very things. Now, they didn't use exactly the same language that I'm using. I'm tending to use language that is more connected to Thomas Aquinas, my favorite philosopher. But it's that thinking that there is something that transcends, that something true about human nature that points to something beyond ourselves, and there are certain goods to which we're ordered, and the government, if it's going to do its job right, has to make sure that those are protected. And that's why we have laws against things like murder, theft. In our country, we have the Bill of Rights, right, are meant to protect what we believe are these fundamental rights, including the right to religious liberty. And the right to religious liberty is connected to the right relationship that at least the founders thought this way, that human beings have a natural inclination to have a right relationship with that which is transcendent, namely God. And for them, religious liberty was always connected to God in some way. They had experience from Europe of the wars on religion, and they thought, you know, we don't want to replicate that here in the United States, so some form of religious liberty has to exist, some way to protect conscience.
Why is it so important? And this is kind of taking a quick move forward, but you've talked about this in many different forms, the importance of understanding different economic theories. So the difference between capitalism and communism, the difference between Marxism and socialism, I really want you to underscore how important it is for Christians to understand this.
Yeah, that's something I bring up in the book, because in the Christian world, you know, Christians hold different views about the relationship between economics and social justice. And I think all Christians believe that the church has an obligation. In fact, we are told in Scripture to be charitable, to extend our resources to help the poor. True religion is manifested in helping the widow and the orphan, right? This is part of the nature of our faith. But Christians will disagree on the extent to which this should be exercised by the government. And here, I think, as I say in the book, we should become conversant on those forms of economics that do the best in lifting the poor out of their poverty. We also have to be careful, though. So I'm a strong defender of the free market. And I don't explicitly state that in the book, because I'm not in the book, you know, defending one view over the other. So I'm a strong defender of the free market economy. However, I do think we have to be careful, and it is a mistake that some of our libertarian friends make. They extend the free market understanding to every aspect of life. And so once you start thinking that everything is reducible to a commodity, I think you get things like the prevalence of pornography and the reducing of everything to a kind of quantifiable, numerical, everything gets to be monetized. And I think that's a mistake as well. The example I use in class, I told my students, I hate using my GPS for Google, because sometimes I don't want the shortest route. I want the most enjoyable one. And the assumption that's built into Google Maps and all these maps is that is efficiency. But efficiency isn't the only value. And the problem with, I think, using free market thinking for everything in life is that we tend to then think that efficiency is the most important value. So I think as Christians, we have to be, you know, open to the possibility that we have to look at different economic systems which can advance the cause of the poor best. But we also have to be at times skeptical when people suggest that, oh, we should look at everything through the lens of economics. That's a mistake as well. And I see this in my own experience in the academy, where administrators at my university and elsewhere will ask professors, well, what are the outcomes in your class? What are your quantifiable outcomes? Well, when you're teaching a class like ethics, what can you say? Well, I want my students to be good. Of course I do. But I can't give you a number for that. I can't quantify it. In fact, the only way I can really know that outcome for sure is after they're dead, right? So I think we have to, you know, we have to be conversant with economics and see what sort of systems work best. But we also have to recognize not everything can be monetized, that there are certain goods in life that economics should serve, but those shouldn't serve economics.
But I think, as you've pointed out over the years, and certainly point out in your book, it's so critical for a Christian to understand how wealth is created, how the markets work, what sorts of government policies increase jobs, what type of monetary policy results in inflation, and so forth. Because if you don't understand this, and I don't know if I got this idea from your book, I just can't remember, but there's a classic case in point with a government program called Aid to Families with Dependent Children.
Yeah.
Well, that particular government program actually exacerbated poverty, and we wouldn't be supporting it as Christians if we understood how wealth is created and how markets work.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's an example I do use in the book. Another example is one that occurred during the first George Bush's presidency. They created this excessive luxury tax, like on yachts, in order to raise more government revenues. And what happened is that, yeah, they did increase revenue slightly, but what happened was that the people that weren't extremely wealthy just stopped purchasing those high-end items, right? So the extremely wealthy didn't affect, right? But what also happened is that all the people that worked on those yachts, the people that cleaned it, the caterers, lost their jobs. And so they actually changed the law because everyone thought, oh, we're just going to, you know, this will tax the rich more. Well, it turned out the people that were really harmed by this were the people that worked on those luxury items that were not wealthy at all, right? They wind up, you know, not having any place to work. And so, you know, you have to be careful, right? So if you're a president or a member of Congress, and if you're a Christian who is interested in making sure policies advance the common good, you have to look at it in its all its dimensions, not just simply in terms of, you know, look how much money the government is getting here, but maybe some of the consequences for those who are not wealthy is not what you would have intended.
One of the things I wanted to broach with you is cultural Marxism and whether or not cultural Marxism is a threat to liberal democracy. And the reason I'm asking this question is one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter pointed out that she and her co-founders were trained Marxists. So you have Marxism not just as an ideology, but you have a Marxist cultural ideology that's impacting our nation as we speak. So again, what's cultural Marxism and what does this have to do with social justice and things like critical race theory?
Yeah, so that's something that I don't know a lot about cultural Marxism, but I will tell you what I think people mean by it. I've done a little bit of reading on it, but there's a wide range of views about what exactly it is. But let me just tell you what original Marxism was. Marx emphasized class differences between groups of people, between those that were very wealthy, those very poor, and the middle class. And his ideal was to have a classless society, one in which class differences based on wealth ceased to be. And so you get different sorts of nations that have, in one way or another, attempted that. We think of the former Soviet Union and many of the nations that were behind what we call the Iron Curtain. Cultural Marxism, it's not so much, doesn't really care about class differences. It cares about what is called identity politics. So the differences have to do with one's level as oppressed. So if you want to sort of compare cultural Marxism to old Marxism, the old Marxists say the bourgeois, the people that have all the wealth and everything today, sort of the cultural Marxist, that's equivalent to white heterosexual Christian male, right? They're the oppressors. And then underneath that, you have a variety of different identities, right? Whether it's LGBTQ, Black, Hispanic, and so forth. And the role of the state is in some ways to, you know, advance the interest of those that are oppressed. Now, there's a lot of things that one can say about this. One, I think what I just told you in terms of identity and those categories, I think, are simplistic. The idea that you can actually make distinctions of individuals based on their identity or racial or sexual category, I think, is absurd. There are people that are white, heterosexual, male Christians who are impoverished, right? And then there are those that fit any of the other categories who are doing quite well, right? But part of it has to do with not just wealth, but also a kind of elimination of negative judgments, a kind of that recognition of identity. Now, in terms of the race question, I think Christians can clearly acknowledge that there's a lot that at least those of us who are white Christians have to do to, you know, reach out to our Black brothers and sisters. And we have different histories, but we have a common faith. And it's ultimately grounded in the fact that we are all made in the image of God. And I think when we move to other questions, and this is where it gets really, I think, difficult for Christians in the public square, questions about gender, the transgender issues, where you have cases, several of them at different universities, where professors have refused to use what the individual student wants to be called in terms of a pronoun. And this, I think, is as much different than the question of race. Obviously, cultural Marxists would disagree with me on that. And I think one of the difficulties with talking through these issues is that those that are cultural Marxists want to lump all of them together. And I think that that is a, I think it's a mistake. And I also think what it does in terms of the Christian community can be truly pernicious. So we have many Black brothers and sisters in Christ that we are united with on a lot of cultural questions. And I think as Christians, we have to work together to preserve not only the integrity of our own communities, but also our integrity as a church. And that means standing up for religious liberty and the right for Christian communities to be able to make judgments on these questions of moral theology that are, I think, being challenged by kind of secular views on human sexuality. Yeah. So there's a lot of things here, Hank. And as I said, I'm no expert on cultural Marxism, but
I think your comments just prove that you really are.
Oh, well.
Anyway, I want to jump to something really quickly because, you know, otherwise we'll be here until Christmas. And I'd be fine with that because I love talking to you. But I want you to talk about free will. Both you and I have a robust view of libertarian freedom, freedom of the will. How important is this notion to the overall concept of religious freedom?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a couple of different issues here. One is this sort of general question about sort of the metaphysical question of human free will. And you and I don't think I've ever discussed this before. I know that you and I are both not Calvinists, so.
I'm Orthodox, and you're Catholic.
Yeah, and I'm a Thomist. So I, you know, in terms of the sort of the general sort of metaphysical question of free will, I think, I agree. I think human beings do have libertarian free will. But I also believe in divine providence. And so I think that God has the power to be able to work through us while we exercise our free will. And, well, how does he do that? I don't know. It's a mystery. And I'm willing to live with lots of mysteries. So the example I've used actually with my students on this, I said, how many of you believe the Bible is God's word? They all raised their hand. I said, but yeah, but we say Paul wrote Romans. How'd that happen? How could Paul write Romans and it be God's word? Did Paul write Romans freely? Yes. Oh, so it's possible for God to exercise his power without limit and at the same time do it through a free person. if you can understand that, then you can understand that you can have divine providence and free will.
I love what you're saying right now. I mean, I just absolutely love it. I oftentimes say that it is so comfortable for me to live in the land of antinomy. There's so many tensions, and we can't explain all those tensions, and so it's so wonderful to live in the land of antinomy, to live in this land of tension and recognize that the tensions are real and they're mysteries beyond our ken.
Yeah, I think back to my younger self when I was in my 30s, and I, as a young philosopher, I thought of my Christian faith as something, it's a kind of intellectual puzzle. Not that that's all it was, but it really was dominant in my mind. And now I look and I think, if I had solved the puzzle, I'd lose the faith. And I don't mean to say that faith and reason are opposed. I don't believe that at all. But I do think that the fact that I don't want to worship a God I can figure out, I mean, that just to me is like, that's almost a form of idolatry. So, yeah, the whole idea of mystery, I think, as I've gotten older, has actually been more comforting than anything.
Yeah, a bunch of things I want to talk to you about. Let's see if we can hit these quickly. I can't help but think, as I'm speaking to you right now, Frank, about Amy Coney Barrett and Senator Feinstein's remark that the dogma lives loudly within you. When I heard that, it was like fingers on a chalkboard, because I was thinking immediately that while she's saying that, the dogma lives loudly within her as well. I mean, no one comes to issues like politics with a white lab coat on. We all have our biases.
That's right. Yeah, I'm always amazed at how kind of not self-aware certain people are about that. Years ago, when I was at UNLV, I had a colleague in the communications department. Her name was Barbara Cloud. She's now since passed away. She's a delightful woman, but she came up to me one day. It was after my first year of teaching, and she said, I noticed in the catalog that you are teaching a course called Contemporary Moral Issues. How can you be objective and you're publicly pro-life? And I told her that, of course, I introduced my students to arguments by people who I don't agree with, and I try to be fair-minded. And then I turned to her and said, Barbara, you know, there are other professors who teach that course in the department who are pro-choice. Why don't you ask them the same question? And she was silent for about 3 or 4 seconds, and she goes, wow, I never thought of that before.
Hmm.
And that just, I mean, it shows you that there are people, and I'm sure I've been guilty of this myself, where they don't think of their view as a view. They think of it as sort of obvious, and other people hold views. And I think that happens when you kind of live in a bubble. And I think especially in the academic world, where a vast majority of the faculty are left of center and they come across a conservative, they sort of say, well, how can that person be a good teacher? It's they don't think of their own views as views. So, yeah, so the Feinstein comment, yeah, of course, she's got dogmas too, right? She holds views that she thinks are that she won't compromise on. And we all do. And in fact, you can't live without them.
You can't live without them. That's absolutely right. You know, maybe you could make a few comments as we close this podcast on the news media today. This is a big canard, a big, big issue to tackle, and sad to only spend a few minutes on it. But, you know, I read 3 newspapers every morning. I read our local newspaper. I read USA Today. I read the Wall Street Journal. And one of the things that has struck me over the past few years, and this is becoming increasingly difficult for me to continue reading the newspapers, is that the news is so slanted. It's no longer news, it's opinion pieces. And you have so much disinformation that's being communicated in the interest of news. For example, and you know, this isn't an attempt to be partisan, but I was reading newspaper stories about President Trump, who allegedly disparaged American dead war heroes as losers and suckers. I've never seen any evidence that backs up the claim that he says this, but it's communicated as though it is true. You have Chris Wallace in the first presidential debate saying critical race theory is just sensitivity training when he must surely know that it is not. How does a liberal democracy function with a corrupt press?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's several reasons why this has happened. I think one, I think we've always had, obviously, in this country, at least prior to the beginning of the 20th century, most newspapers, you know, usually took sides, right? But there was a distinction between the news coverage and the editorial page. And over time, at least by the middle of the 20th century, journalism as a profession began thinking of itself as sort of kind of objective communicators of facts in the world. So what you had was a kind of professionalism where if somebody like really blew it, they'd be punished, right? They would, you know, they lose their status, readers would quit getting the paper, you know, they wouldn't be subject to certain awards, right? So, but now there's actually no punishment. You know, there's no actual downside, right? You can say things that are completely false, or you can say things that you're just not sure are true, or you can mischaracterize things, and there's no actual downside. Just the other day, I read a tweet by Dan Rather on the doctrine of originalism and about interpreting the Constitution, and Rather said, well, if you believe in originalism, then you should, you know, want to go back to a time where we didn't have electricity and modern technology. And I read that thinking, he can't really believe that's what originalism means, right? And so I actually retweeted it with a comment, and I said, you know, at one point in our history, this man was one of three people that we listened to in nightly news. And, you know, even if we didn't agree with their politics, we thought that they were at least informed, well-read, and well-studied. Now we know, thanks to Twitter, that that probably was never true. But Rather would have not done that. If he had done that on the nightly news, let's say in 1984, he would have been taken off the air. Now it doesn't matter. And what I think people don't realize is that it not only harms the republic, but it also harms the people that engage in it, right? So what kind of people do we become when we do those things, especially if we're like negligent or intentional on it, right? It actually changes our character. But, you know, I don't know what the answer is. You know, and you add to it social media and the way in which Facebook and Twitter and these other social media companies essentially have become the gatekeepers, become almost quasi-government agencies deciding on what gets published. It's a real scary thing.
It is a scary thing. But it's so important for us as Christians to be well-informed. And that's why I'm so delighted to recommend your book, Politics for Christians. Some of the parts are really intriguing to read. Some take a little more work to digest, but it's really worth it because we can curse the darkness or we can build a lighthouse in the midst of the gathering storm. And I think your book, Politics for Christians, Statecraft as Soulcraft, really does build a lighthouse in the midst of the gathering storm. Frank, I have appreciated you and what you have done in Christian apologetics, philosophy, and many other disciplines for many, many years. I've benefited, and I'm really grateful for the time that you spent with us on Hank Unplugged today.
Well, thank you, Hank. I'm honored that you invited me on again. It was enjoyable as always.
Well, thanks, and hi to Frankie, and may you continue for many years raising up students, writing. You're making a difference while there is yet time. And for everyone tuned in to Hank Unplugged today, remember that this podcast is dependent on your rates and reviews. That's what gets us into the earbuds of thousands of people, perhaps many, many more all around the world. So thanks for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of the podcast.